This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
You realize that for the last, 3,000 years, we have been living in a world of scribal schools.
Yeah. So,
Brandeis University, welcome to Recall This Book, a podcast that looks backward to see into the future. Our idea is to assemble scholars and writers from different disciplines to make sense of contemporary issues, problems, and events by looking at the books that shaped the world we inherited. Today, the hosts are Elizabeth Ferry. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hi, John.
Noted anthropologist Elizabeth Ferry. And me, John Plotz. Hello, me. And we are joined today by Martin Puchner. Hello, Martin.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And you are, I will tell you, the Byron and Anita Wien Professor of English and Comparative Literature at Harvard University. You're the editor of the Norden Anthology of World Literature, the author, among many books, of The Written World, The Power of Stories to Shape People, History, and Civilization, published by Penguin in 2017. Okay, so welcome, Martin, to our miniature sound-insulated bar. Think of yourself as grabbing a tumbler of your favorite amber liquid, or maybe a carafe of your favorite amber liquid, and getting ready to banter, okay?
I'm ready.
You feel banter ready? You look
yeah,
banter
absolutely.
Ready. You look like banter weight. Okay, so we're going to hear more about the specifics of your book, Martin, The Written World, in a few minutes. But I just want to start by noticing that this is in effect, that what your book does is in effect a meta version of what our podcast tries to do. That is, we try to isolate single books and understand how they resonate with the present world. But you actually go whole hog and you put our entire modern culture, as it were, under the shadow of books. So you want to explore how the technology of writing developed over centuries and the ways that sometimes without our even noticing or acknowledging it, its basic assumptions shape us. So that's, you have meta us, and we appreciate that. So with the pleasant prospect of turning to hearing about your book shortly, Martin, we want to start today with Elizabeth talking about one of the oldest books out there. So Elizabeth, turning over to you.
Okay. Nice to meta you. I want to start by talking about one of the texts that Martin discusses in the earlier part of his book, which is the Epic of Gilgamesh. And I want to focus, this is my contribution for the week, a particular translation, or actually it's known as a new rendering in English verse by David Ferry. No relation. Just kidding. It's my dad. By my dad.
It's the law of the father.
That's right. In a second, I'm going to read you just a few lines from it. One of the things I really appreciated about the book, The Written World, is the sense that it conveys of literature and writing and particular bundles of writing as contributing to a kind of, transtemporal society of writing. You could talk about it. Maybe you could talk about it as a kind of fabric of writing. And I think that my father's work, and particularly Gilgamesh, has been a really good example of that. I sometimes sort of say to my father that he, in the same way in which you might find architectural salvage stores in kind of hipstery neighborhoods that have like all kinds of little features from houses and stuff, that his specialty is poetic salvage.
And I have to say, I love this rendering of your father's. I find it very moving that it's your father who did it. And I would say it's, to my mind, it's much more than salvage. It's really complete renovation. It got renovation of the Gilgamesh, because it comes across in this version as such a readable, such a, in some sense, familiar sound because of the iambic pentameter. Uh-huh, so yeah. I think it's actually a great example of a complete renovation.
That's great. I like the gut renovation idea.
Though I kind of want to put a footnote down to cut back to the question of sound, because one of the things I really like about what you do with the question of writing, Martin, is that you make us think twice about the possibility of sonic or acoustic preservation, because things can be preserved in writing that are like, it's like the non-oral side of the language that gets saved. So what it means to save the sound, which I'm not saying you can't save the sound, you definitely can, but it is interesting because I think about writing as going to the far end of language away from the sound. So
I wonder if meter would be an interesting sort of bridge for that, right? Because it's kind of encoded, sound is encoded into the question of meter.
That's right, and I feel like there's a lot of Latin words that we know how to pronounce only because we have them in poems that tell us what the metrical rule was. Yeah, that's a good point.
That's interesting.
Okay. There's so much to connect there to what your book is about, Martin, but maybe we can just, you know, pivot here and say, you know, you've written this amazing book, which there's so many things about it I would love to talk about. I'd love to talk about the stages of writing that you describe, because you have a really subtle argument that you lay out right at the beginning of this book, which is enormously accessible, but also is arguing on a number of levels. And so you have this argument where you take us through the different stages that you see writing having gone through to bring us into the modern age. So I'd love to talk about that, but maybe there's also a direct connection to the Gilgamesh stuff that you'd want to...
Yeah, I mean, the Epic of Gilgamesh for me is it's the beginning of my story. I try to tell the story of literature, really, which I understand as the intersection of oral storytelling and writing technologies. And since Mesopotamia is the place where the first writing system was developed, where that first crossing of oral storytelling and writing technologies happened, it makes sense that the first great written piece of literature in world literature came from that part of the world, came from Mesopotamia. And so the Epic of Gilgamesh is that for me. And what's so crucial about it is that from the beginning, it presents itself as a written text. And that's very different from later epics, like the Homeric epics that present themselves as being sung orally. The world of both Homeric epics is a world without writing, with one small exception. And so it's really a very oral world, even though it's much later. But this much earlier text, first epic, the Epic of Gilgamesh, really is very clear about being written down, that this is a world that invented writing, that that's a great achievement of this culture. And so really fully embraces writing in a way that's very exciting for me.
I think you really get at that very inventively by kind of telling the parallel story of how the writing was decoded in the 19th century and how that sort of it's a trope that we have read in kids' books and so on, but sort of the way in which you link it to these questions of the fundamentalness of the written word and of this as writing is really effective, I think.
And that story of the rediscovery really speaks to one feature that's so important, namely that writing endures, that it starts a kind of sense of history where you can discover old texts and know that you in some way through writing can speak to the future. And that's very clear in one of the biggest fans of the Epic of Gilgamesh, the much later King Ashurbanipal, who finds these tablets and starts to read them and thinks of them, is so amazed by the fact that they are so ancient, from before the flood, he says. And then he also imagines that they will endure into the future. And they did, although they almost disappeared, they were discovered really by accident in the 19th century in the Seifert. So really, it's a very atypical example in some sense that a piece of literature that was so important disappeared for 2,000 years and then reappeared.
And Mart, in that context, what's the significance of the fact that we have Gilgamesh in these two entirely different languages? That some of the stories are preserved in one language group and then others in a later language? Like, do we imagine that as telling a story about how dead languages can keep procreating even, you know, back in the early days?
Exactly. And the fact that the whole concept of a dead language was really a kind of inadvertent byproduct of writing. There were no dead languages before writing, because if a language died, it died.
It was no longer there to be called dead, right?
Yeah. Exactly. But what's interesting about the writing system, cuneiform writing, is that because it wasn't phonetic, it could be used for different languages. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened. So there are these early Sumerian songs, the earliest layer of the Epic of Gilgamesh, and then the later Akkadian ones. But they all used the same writing system.
Yeah. And how does that get to that question that we raised earlier, or that I was tugging on earlier, about sound? So you're saying that the sounds were not preserved.
That's right. I mean, that's for me, the interesting part of the story is what happens when the alphabet emerges. And the alphabet is, you know, for us, it's such a familiar, it's so clearly much easier than a writing system like the cuneiform, the cuneiform system or other logographic systems where you have hundreds of signs. But the alphabet was really a kind of conceptual breakthrough, because all the earlier writing systems had a connection between the signs and concepts. And what basically had to happen with the alphabet is that you had to sever writing from meaning. You would chop up words into meaningless sound entities and then recombine them. And so there's something that happens that was first developed in Phoenicia, in today's Lebanon, and then was perfected in Greece. So the first sort of fully sound poem, in a way, were the ones that were preserved in alphabetic languages.
Although it's interesting, like it seems both potentially like a breakthrough in a kind of progressive sense, but something is lost too, right? Because, you know, for instance, I mean, and it's not completely lost, like we see this in Chinese, right? That there's, you know, different, same writing system, which is, you know, concept-based writing system. And then people who would never be able to understand each other speaking face-to-face have this complete kind of transparency through the written word.
Right. Now, and in East Asia, my example for that is what's called brush talk, where the Japanese would send emissaries to China, and they couldn't understand each other orally, but they could speak by using the Chinese signs, because they both use these Chinese signs, so they could communicate that way, the way we might communicate with someone else whose language we don't speak, but who uses the same Arabic numerals, right? We could negotiate with someone by writing numbers on a piece of paper, because these numbers are not phonetically coded, but abstract symbols.
Right.
Except nowadays we do the same thing by talking into Google Translate and holding your cell phone up to each other. Right. So I just want to say,
tablet, right?
It's true. It's the new kind of tablet. But I guess in terms of one of the other briefs of the podcast is to try to figure out where we are in, you know, 2019, where these writing technologies are. So just, I hope we circle back to that question of the visibility of writing that you're describing, because in some ways, one way to think about what's happening now is that we have all of this invisible writing that is like all this code, which is written to tell our computers what to do. So somebody wrote it, it's in language, but then it becomes subterranean, so that everything we're surrounded by has all sorts of writing in it, which is inaccessible to us. So, so Martin, can you talk a little bit more about the historical stages that you see?
Yes, and what was important for me is basically to defamiliarize our conception of how literature is produced, namely by professional authors who invent new stories, original stories, and then bring these stories to a mass audience or an audience through print or other methods of replication. And what's so striking is that for the first 2,000-3,000 years in the story of literature, it's a very different form. There aren't really authors. There are scribes, and scribes don't invent stories. They collect them and mm-hmm. arrange them and preserve them mm-hmm. and collate them mm-hmm. and frame them and accumulate them. They're these producing these kind of story bundles or text bundles, mm-hmm. Like the Epic of Gilgamesh or the Hebrew Bible or later, story collections like the Arabian Nights and others.
Mm-hmm. Or famous anthologies like the Norton Anthology, for instance, right?
That's true.
Yeah. It's true.
But also famous anthologies like the Bible, too, right?
Right.
So I want to pick up on the word that you use, Elizabeth, curate, because I feel like that's a very much a word of the moment now. Like, we live in a society in which content creation is cheap, but curating is valuable. Like, uh-huh. what the people who have their hands on the levers of power are not the people who produce the words originally, but the ones who distribute them. You know, it's when Amazon chooses to serve
you. Or at least they try to make that claim, right?
That's true.
Yeah. I think that's an ongoing struggle.
It's an ongoing struggle. That's true. So, yeah, can you talk more about that? Do you think of those scribes as doing an act of conscious curation? Because it seems to me when you bundle, you know, it could be bundling because it's a job, you're aggregating, or it could be bundling where you're really making meaning from the way that you bundle stories together.
Oh, I definitely think, I mean, that was mm-hmm. their main job, I would say, to make meaning through selection and combination and framing and presentation. And I think you're so right that the same mode has now come back. And I would say precisely because that standard modern system of production I just described with professional authors who invent mm-hmm. original stories is now, with our media revolution, breaking down. And to some extent, we get these older versions coming back. And the mm-hmm. primacy now placed on curation, I think, is an example of that, mm-hmm. that we, again, are moving into a world where there aren't these it's not dominated by these professional authors who have complete control over their stories. There's all this kind of writing and material out there. And what really matters is how to collect and frame it and filter and present it, mm-hmm. right. curate it.
Yeah. Yeah. Although I would again maybe feel like so if we could think of that process by which, you know, kind of authorship is becoming democratized, then it's in the interest of certain people to say, oh, wait, it's actually the curating that's valuable. It wasn't the writing, you know, as soon as more people can write suddenly.
Oh, right. So you're basically putting pressure on the question of what value means there.
Yeah.
Because there's a world of kind of proliferating slash fiction or, and, you know,
right.
all these
and there's
forms
a,
of
there's
generation.
A, you know, a sort of dethroning of certain kinds of publishing houses or other kinds of things, right?
So in other words, once publication becomes democratized, it loses value.
And therefore,
yeah.
there needs to be these sort of niches. I mean, the parallel
I wouldn't want to join to any club that would have me as a member, basically.
Maybe, like, yeah. Or the parallel might be like, as financial information becomes, you know, more widely accessible, then you need to have people who are portfolio managers, right?
Right.
Who are the ones who, you know, and suddenly the expertise is not understanding a particular company. It's, oh, no, you have to understand how these things go together, which is a form of curation.
Right. Though Martin, in terms of the work you did about the scribes, do you get a sense of the scribe as existing in a kind of elevated social status? Like, are they is that a priest class?
Yeah, it's not necessarily priests, but sometimes they are, but definitely elevated. It was wonderful for me to read some of these earliest fragments from scribal schools, where you get, we're talking about 3,000 years ago, you get students complaining about their teachers saying, oh, my teacher was too hard on me. My teacher beat me. My teacher, you know, is a taskmaster. And you also have, and I think we as teachers can sympathize with that, fragments from teachers saying, you know, this generation of students is not taking things as seriously as we used to.
So-and-sos.
Exactly. And so you get, you realize that for the last, 3,000 years, we have been living in a world of scribal schools.
Yeah.
So,
the next stage in your argument, and forgive me, Martin, if I butcher it, but that you are interested in this sort of great teacher moment. And I think you think about it's Socrates, right? And I imagine the Buddha.
Confucius. Buddha and Jesus.
And Jesus, right. Mm-hmm. And so If I understand the quirk of your argument, which I really like, is that the teacher is presented as anti-writing in some ways. Like there's oral, charismatic presence of the teacher. And yet, of course, you know, as with the story of Socrates and Plato, we only get them because somebody writes them down.
Right. And so for me, the interesting thing is that these teachers, these charismatic teachers, live in some of the most literate cultures of their time.
Yeah.
So they could have written and they chose not to. And they, as you say, they really base everything on the primacy of the spoken word, this live interaction with their students. And of those, Socrates makes the most explicit argument against writing, that you can't control it, that you can't ask follow-up questions. There's lots of scope for misinformation, very similar to the wars we now have about internet, that there's fake news through writing so on and so forth. And so that's how they operate. So it's really almost a moment as writing takes over more and more functions of these societies. There's this moment of panic or moral worry or thinking about...
So is it a backlash argument then?
I think it is to some extent a backlash, yes. Hmm. But then the interesting thing is, as you point out with Plato and others, that the teachers die.
Yeah.
And for some time, usually there's a tradition of oral transmission. In the case of Socrates, almost immediate turn of writing. But sooner or later, these students, in a sense, betray their teachers. They use writing even though their teachers had not. And then the students write down their master's words. So the interesting thing, though, is that these texts these students produce are very different from these older scribal texts, because I think these students try to preserve some of that live interaction. In a sense, some of that rejection of writing in these texts. So they produce, like Plato, dramatic dialogues. They show the back and forth between teacher and students. They describe these situations in a way they almost as if they channeled that.
Or resistance. Sermons. They write down sermons.
Exactly. Yep.
Right.
But also in the case of Jesus, there are lots of, you know, conversations, dialogues with followers. So to me, it's almost as if they channel that resistance, that panic, that skepticism, this Luddite attitude towards writing back into writing and produce these very vivid, anecdotal, dramatic, dialogic texts.
So then what do you make of the kind of overt intertextuality of the New Testament with the Old Testament, the way in which the words of Jesus as recorded or the words of the, you know, original sages of the New Testament are also consciously looking back at, you know, the antitype of the Hebrew Bible that went before?
Yeah, I think it's one of the most fascinating moments in literary history, because you have Jesus who doesn't write, who presents himself as the fulfillment of the scripture, but who doesn't produce his own scripture.
Does Jesus himself give evidence of knowing the Hebrew scripture? He does.
Yes. Okay. So he knows the Hebrew Bible.
Uh-huh.
He's learned it. He knows how to write. There's one scene in which he writes something in sand, but that's the only moment of writing, and then the wind blows it off, and we don't know what he writes.
Which is itself a criticism of writing, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so, but then his followers, of course, produce texts, but texts that at first, as I said, try to capture this vivid, you know, sermonizing, dialogic, charismatic figure who didn't write. But then as Christianity develops its own identity and splits off from Judaism, it more and more these texts acquire the status of a new sacred scripture, and then the question is, how will they relate to the older scripture? And that's where you get the Old Testament and the New Testament.
That's
so over time they acquire that status, but not initially. Initially, they're just student writing about their charismatic master.
Right. But so could you say qualitatively that moment of the intertextuality between the old and new is akin to the bundling of stories that the scribes are doing before, or is it of a different order?
So I would say that you can describe what we would call the New Testament as itself a bundle of stories, because it's, you know, it's the Gospels, it's Paul's letters, it's and so on and so forth.
Sure.
It's a bunch of different kinds of texts. But it seems to me the suturing of this new corpus of texts back to the old, then what now is called looking backwards from this Christian perspective,
the Old Testament,
that's a very unusual and kind of unique moment. You don't have that with the texts of the other master teachers. You don't have Buddhist texts trying to reconnect themselves to their Vedas, for example. Mm-hmm. You have it to some extent maybe in the in the Confucian traditions, because there you have students of the of Confucius writing down his texts. But then interestingly, Confucius, because he becomes so important, is retroactively seen as the editor of one of the first fundamental texts of the Chinese literary tradition, I mean, the classic of song, even though he didn't write them and he didn't edit them, but stories circulate that he is the editor, and so that's why we call them Confucian classics. So maybe that is something to some extent similar to
that's
what
really
you have
interesting.
With the New Testament and the Old Testament.
Yeah. So I kind of want to pivot at this point to say that, you know, you end your book, Martin, by saying that a second revolution in the written world is upon us. And I'd love to make that the occasion for like the final section of this podcast, in which we think about what it means for that new revolution to come. I mean, you already heard my point about computer code as a form of writing, but I think there's a lot of ways that we could think about this new electronic age we're in. So can I yield the floor to you on that question?
Yeah. Definitely. And you know, I basically, the motivation for my book was the experience we are living through, that we live through this fundamental revolution in writing technologies, and we feel that it has profound impacts. And I wanted to, in a sense, to get some orientation, some guidance from the past. What were earlier moments when similar revolutions happened? Of course, with print, but also with paper and smaller revolutions along the way. So that's very much what's the motivation, sort of the prehistory of that. And what was interesting for me is that I see now some of the older modes of writing and the organization of the written world coming back. We just spoke about the return of editing or of curating.
Powerful curators.
Exactly. Yeah. But there are others too. I mean, you know, we started this podcast with the Epic of Gilgamesh, which is written on these clay tablets. Tablets went out of fashion, were replaced by scrolls and the Roman invention of the codex, which we know by the book. But now, of course, for the first time, we're using tablets again. And in my book, I have images of ancient scribes who are sitting cross-legged with looking down at the tablet in their in their lap. And, you know, if I squint outside the door here in the library, I bet I can find someone who's sitting right in that same pose with the tablet.
But doesn't feel like a little bit of a shallow rhyme to you, though? Because those tablets are so protean, whereas the point about those earlier tablets was that they were so fixed.
Yeah, but it's a question about formats. Yeah. The other format that has come back is the scroll. The scroll was more or less replaced by the book, and we are scrolling down computer screens.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Including on
these
tablets.
Yeah.
So in part because computers encode text as a continuous line of text rather than splitting it up into pages.
Yeah. And it changes our bodies and our ways of seeing.
Absolutely.
And,
So I do think that these formats and these forms actually do matter. This is not to say that there's a lot that's new, but I've been struck by the fact that just the way our bodies relate to reading devices and forms, that there's something from the deep history of writing that's suddenly come back.
So now I'm just remembering dimly from college hearing a lecture by Peter Stalibras in which he was saying that the invention of the codex, the book with the spine, was a revolution in discontinuous access. You know, that the point is that the scroll gives you...
You have to turn
the page. Yeah, right. So, not that you have to turn the page, that you can go anywhere so that you get people jumping back and forth.
So the index
evolves at the same time that the book does.
Neat.
So... but by that logic, it seems like the electronic writing we have is like intensification of that discontinuous access. I mean, I hear what you're saying about scrolling, but the thing to me about
the searchable index.
Yeah, like the searchability of the way that the hyperlinked logic of reading on a screen is that you're continuously able to just jump to some other place in the text.
I think it's both. I mean, I've certainly had the experience of having to, you know, needing to jump forward on a computer and having to scroll through, especially in some cases where you have to, where it simulates books and maybe it's the computer's a little slow and you have to think, oh my God, I wish I could just take the physical book and flip forward and
that's
you can't do it. Although, of course, with the index, you have searchability.
Yeah. But, I mean, I'm just thinking of Control F. I mean, Control F for me is like, you know, that's a habitual movement. It's like, I want to find the next
move.
Yeah, like tell me the next time the word papyrus shows up in this text.
Right.
So
definitely.
Yeah.
It's both those things. Yeah, so this is the moment, I think, in the podcast when we switch to what we call recallable books. So we basically ask you, each of us is going to say a book, you know, given the nature of this conversation, a book that we think would be, you know, the kind of thing that somebody who enjoyed this podcast might want to go off and read. Mm-hmm. So, Martin, as our guest, can I offer you first shot?
Well, in the spirit of this conversation, I'm not going to recommend a book because a book, John, is from the past age of literature. We've now entered an age with fan fiction.
I know. Where 2018 of me.
Where everyone is an author. So I'm going to recommend a website, Wattpad. It's a Canadian website. It's now in every country except China. Uh-huh. And it started as a fan fiction site and is primarily used originally by teenagers, often female teenagers, or people who pretend to be teenagers. And it started as a fan fiction site, but it's grown and exploded into a storytelling universe. And there are all kinds of stories that are being written by users, by readers, by people who don't necessarily think of themselves as authors in the Gutenberg sense and who generate stories. And I'm amazed how widespread it is. I was talking about it in a graduate seminar a few weeks ago, and one of the students said, "Oh yeah, my mother has two novels on Wattpad."
Well.
And so it's really, and now some of these, because this website has grown so much, it has so many users, that the top stories get big book deals, they get Netflix tie-ins. It's become huge. And the website, what's fascinating to me is that the website, people running the website, they have unbelievable data about storytelling and different kinds of stories and the way readers interact with stories. So I think it both registers how storytelling and who produces stories and how we use them and interact with them and how we distribute them and circulate them changes. But I think it will also, the analytics of it will actually tell us a lot about storytelling in the future. Mm.
So you can post in any language?
It's in many languages. Yeah.
It is. Yeah. And are they translated? Do people read things in other languages, or do you just stick to your own language community?
That's a good question. I'm not sure about translation. Yeah, I'm not sure how that works.
That is fascinating. Mm. Okay. Elizabeth?
So I'm also going to go in the fan fiction route, and also not suggest a book, but it's a particular fan fiction story, which is called No Reservations, Narnia, which is the Anthony Bourdain, an imagined Anthony Bourdain episode in Narnia, which kind of brings together both this...
Do they eat wood shrew?
No, but they do dine with werewolves, you know, because they have this, you know, he's sort of having all these ceremonial dinners and they're super bland and starchy. And then finally he meets a werewolf who takes him to the, you know, because there's always in Anthony Bourdain, there's always the moment, the dart towards the wild. Right. So but, you know, so that's sort of both an example of this collectivity that we're describing, and also the creation of a world and how it might get literarily inhabited.
Okay, so this is great. So you guys have backed me into the opposite corner. So I was going to recommend, and I still recommend, it's a great book, a book by Dennis Tenon called Plain Text, The Poetics of Computation, which is basically a book about thinking about computer code as a form of writing. Mm-hmm. But given this world of Wattpad and the proliferation of these stories belonging to us all, I'm going to endorse the opposite, which is something I heard about on a podcast recently, something called the Brautigan Library. Do you guys know this?
As in Richard Brautigan?
As in Richard Brautigan. So Richard Brautigan, in one of his novels, came up with the idea of a library in which people deposited single, unique books that were not meant to be published and reproduced. They were just meant to sit in that library. So in other words, you bring the object itself and it sits in a room, and that then becomes the library. So it's like library as site of anti-publication. So so you go for you go to a room in which the only thing you know about these books is that they only exist in this space. So you guys both look intensely skeptical, but it's a different way of thinking about writing, I think. It's like it's like singling out the one place in the world that this writing exists.
Yeah.
So, I mean, in a sense, maybe you can actually think of it as a curation.
So
it's a curation experiment, right?
Here's a question. Would it be...
But not curation as promulgation. curation as containment.
Right. Yeah. Would it achieve its, would the Braudekin Library achieve its goal even better if there were no readers?
Say more. You mean, well, because if it were just going down a black hole?
Well, if we're continuing on this kind of salvage
idea. It's like enter the singularity.
Sort of, right? Yeah. Like if you, you know.
Well, that would be the potlatch version where you brought it and burned it, you know?
Sort of. But then you would still be in some kind of relationship with the text, even if you brought it. But there's something about, you know, we keep talking about how people are reading things or hearing things and then they're doing something with them. So this is the going there and nothing is done with it. Or that's my question, right? Is it, if it had no readers, would that be more what it was trying to do?
It's a super good question. I don't know. Like, my vision of it is that it's attractive to people because of its one-offness. So that's why it still feels like a curatorial project, because the curation there is kind of like the Museum of Jurassic Technology or something. Like, it's the thing that might have been out in the world but actually isn't. It's only... Right. Here. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, that like in the 19th century, a lot of museums had like plaster casts of famous sculptures so you could go and see.
Yeah.
So this would be the antithesis of that.
Right.
I don't know. Is it like authenticity porn?
I don't know.
Yeah. It's an interesting question. Yeah. It reminds me of the discussion we had with Lisa Gittleman about the allographic versus the autographic.
Right.
So do you know this distinction, Martin, between?
Yeah.
Okay. So.
Yeah. So this is the intensification of the autographic.
Meaning, the notion that the thing that actually lives in a place versus the allographic being the thing that potentially lives anywhere. I'll continue to battle for the Brown again.
I'm not against it. I'm just.
You just think it could be flushed down a toilet and it would still be a Brown again library.
I'm against it. It's precious.
Yeah. Is it?
Yeah, a little bit.
I'm not sure I'm against it.
No, I think you're allowed to be against it.
Come on, make a stand.
Yeah.
I did.
Yeah.
I took it back.
Well, it sort of depends what you mean by the word precious, right?
So that's true.
I kind of agree it is precious. But, you know, Gollum had a point. My precious. okay.
And we're in there.
It's a good. Yes. Unless you guys want to do Gollum imitations too, we could.
Well, we did do the one with the Beckett at the end, so we could all do precious.
All do my precious.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. One, two, three.
Precious.
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 Oh, I like that. It sounds like a musical. So recall this book is the brainchild of John Plotz and Elizabeth Ferry. It's affiliated with Public Books and is recorded and edited in the Media Lab of the Brandeis Library. Our music comes from a song by Eric Chaslow and Barbara Cassidy, Fly Away, like a very beautiful song. Sound editing is by Anil Tripathi in the Anthropology Department, and production assistance, including website design and social media, is done by Matthew Schratz from English. We always want to hear from you with your comments, criticisms, or suggestions for future episodes. You can email us directly or connect us via social media and our website, recallthisbook.org. And finally, if you enjoyed today's show, please be sure to write a review or rate us on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcast. And you may be interested in checking out past episodes, including topics like opiate addiction, minimalism, both literary and aesthetic, as well as home design minimalism, old and new media, and also an interview with Madeline Miller, author of Circe, which is a retelling of some episodes of The Odyssey from below or from the side. And upcoming episodes are likely, we're still finalizing the second half of season one, but the likely upcoming episodes are going to include a conversation with I think you can call him a living legend, Samuel Delaney, science fiction author, discussion of animals, poetical and otherwise, with the poet David Ferry, who we heard a lot about today, and biologist E.O. Wilson, and also a Recall This Book First, a collaboration with Harvard's Mahindra Humanities Center. And in that live episode, you will hear me arguing about distraction with Bard Professor Marina von Zoylen. I perform a Monty Python monologue about word association football, and Marina talks about her brain scan, which is just as scary as that sounds. In any case, Martin, thank you so much for coming today.
Thanks for having me. It was really fun.
It was very fun. And thank you all for listening.
Thanks.